Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, continuing my interview series, Anatomy of an Artist, I am playing an interview I did with Richard Hopkins, who's the artistic director of the Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. Richard's story is unusual. He has dedicated an entire life to theater in many, many, many different forms, and yet he didn't see his first play until he was 19 years old. Listen to how Richard discovered his window to the world. Hang on, here come the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about wondering if who you think you are is all you really are. It may seem an odd question, and yet, based on my experience of more than 30 years as a psychotherapist, and of course my own personal life and the lives of my friends and family, I'm convinced that most of us are hiding aspects of ourselves, that we have qualities, capacities, skills, abilities, ways of being that we haven't tapped. That is, that we are demonstrating in the world some of who we are. We're not lying about what we present. It's just not the whole truth. How can this be so? How is it that we, living as we do within ourselves, can be unaware of something, anything, that is true for us? Well, we're very clever. We're very creative. We're very flexible. And as children, we only have one agenda, and that is to please those giants on whom our lives depend, you know, our parents. Actually, all of the people who care for us. This can mean older siblings, extended family, grandparents, aunts and uncles, sometimes teachers. We know quite well that we are amongst the most vulnerable of species when we are little, completely dependent. We can do nothing. At the beginning, of course, we cannot do anything except kind of flail around and hope for the best. And as we grow, we become aware of our dependence. We become aware that those people who are there all the time, most of the time, hopefully, are the ones that are keeping us alive. And so their satisfaction with us becomes our primary goal. That's not exactly how it's supposed to go. How it's supposed to go is you're to feel completely secure in the fact that those giants think you are the best thing that ever happened and everything about you is terrific. But that doesn't happen to almost any of us, even just in the experience of socializing, because obviously we have to learn not to run out into the street, not to go out without warm clothing, how to behave as a civilized little being. So we have to be constrained. But in those things that are basic to us, who we really are, we're supposed to receive support, acceptance, and encouragement. Few of us do that entirely. And so we learn that some of the things about us need to be, well, first we pretend they're not so, and then we squelch them, and then we deny them, and then we forget we have them. So if you were a really creative kid, sitting around making things out of non-existent, making things out of the paper or the cardboard or the boxes or the pots and pans, and your parent had a thing about productivity and not being frivolous, he or she might very well have squelched a capacity for creativity, which might later have blossomed many number of ways. And you might have found a way to deny these flights of fancies, these imaginations. Imagination can be seen as a bad thing. And so, if you were unlucky enough to find yourself with a parent who thought imagination was a bad thing, and you figured out a way to forget that you have a vivid and extensive imagination, then you are being cheated from something that could not only bring you terrific joy and pleasure, but might actually enhance the world you live in. Maybe you are thinking, maybe you're remembering, as a client of mine once began to draw on the walls in her bedroom with her crayons and learned in no uncertain terms that that was a huge no-no. Maybe you have memories like that, memories of things that you did that were exciting and enlivening and really captured you, only to discover that they really brought down the wrath of someone, or the humiliation of someone, or the teasing of someone, or even the punishment of someone. So this show is all about trying to, well, believe me, that the chances are good that there are aspects of yourself which you could benefit from, which you have denied. And in order to make that point, sometimes I just talk about that for a very long time, but lately my interviews have been so long I haven't had time for much more than simply making this point. And the interviews are another way in which I hope your secret self can be triggered, tickled. When you listen to a person who has dedicated their life or their living to an art, you are listening to someone who, at least in the area of their work, has discovered themselves. And in this interview with Richard, it's rather an interesting story. As you will hear, Richard says he didn't even see a play until he was 19. And he had to kind of be tricked into discovering that theater was something exciting, something he liked, something that felt good to him. And that was the beginning of what has turned into a lifelong dedication to theater. He has been everything, an actor, a director, and now a runner of a theater, the artistic director of the Florida Studio Theater, which is, as you will hear him say, one of the top 10 theaters, even though it's quite small by other theater standards. You will hear not only how he discovered his passion for theater, but also how some of the lessons of his childhood actually came back to help him. They might have gotten in the way, but in this case, they came around to be extremely useful to him. So Richard's a very interesting story, which he's very articulate in expressing. And I'm sure that if you have a hidden theater person inside of you, that person will be intrigued by Richard. So here, Richard Hopkins.
So I'm here with Richard Hopkins, who is the executive artistic creative...
The title is artistic director.
I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that this is true for you.
Mm-hmm. Always has been.
Always has mm-hmm. been. And that's the question I always ask. How did it happen? I mean, I know how much of a passion this is for you. So how did it capture you? When did you find it? How did it happen?
You know, that's a really good question. I think everybody finds their door or window into the arts at a different time and a different path. I did not see a play until I was 19 years old, other than elementary plays.
Wow!
And I was actually taking a speech class at a community college in Columbus, Georgia in the 1960s. And I was, I had no major, I was just feeling my way through, and
You were a speech class. You mean you were in college, but you hadn't
college,
decided
had
what you were...
I junior college, had not chosen a major, didn't know what I wanted to do, took a speaking class because it was a part of the prerequisites for this general liberal arts path that I was on. Anyway, the instructor was also the head of the drama department there. His name was George Nielsen. He was an extraordinary Scotsman with a fiery temper, a great classical actor, very flamboyant. And I was enamored with him, and he told me that if I helped build sets, I would get a better grade on my speaking. And so I started helping build sets, and that's how I was introduced to theater. Then I took a drama, introduction to drama course, and one thing led to another. And I got hooked. What I found out was that I could read a play and hear it. I remember reading Oedipus Rex, mm-hmm. Oedipus the King, and I could hear it. I could hear every voice. I didn't even need to read the character description, the character name. I knew who was speaking. And so I said, wow, this is easy for me. This is something I like. And I started taking more drama classes. And then I transferred to LaGrange College. This was a small department of only 20 or 30 drama majors.
And that's it? You went to major in drama?
I went to major in drama at LaGrange College. Small department, two professors. And I got hooked. And I remember going to this was close to Atlanta. I had still not seen a professional play. I had seen college plays and had seen a community theater play. And a buddy of mine who was a major at the university, he was at the school, he was 2 years ahead of me. I was a sophomore. He was a senior. His name was Noble Shropshire, a very successful actor to this day. And Noble took me with a couple of other guys up to Atlanta, and we went to see a play called Hello, Dolly. And I was watching it, and in the middle of it, I was noticing this small little girl who I said, leaned over to Noel, I said, that's not really a little girl, is it? That's really a young, small actress playing that, isn't it? He said, yes, it is. It was a big hall. There was a national tour. Anyway, and then I leaned over to him a few minutes later, and I said, does she get paid to do that? And he said, yes, she does. So I decided, well, I'm going to try to do this. So then I transferred to Virginia Commonwealth University, which had just changed its name. It had been Richmond Professional Institute. They were the only four-year drama school in America at that time that had a conservatory program. So that I had already completed all of my liberal arts studies in the first 2 years. Now I was a junior going into my junior year, so I transferred, and all I would have to do is study theater.
Wow.
And I studied acting, and I studied directing, and I studied voice, and I studied mime, and I studied intensively for 2 years. And everything I did very intensively.
Yeah, it sounds like great fun.
It was great fun.
I
just totally immersed myself in it. I went from being a very poor student in high school, actually dropped out of high school, and went to a private high school, which is where I learned to study when I was 17. And if it were not for that private high school, I would not have found college.
Yes.
You know, so that it's interesting. Everybody's path is different and interesting.
Well, this is interesting because, well, it's pretty late. And it got you so thoroughly.
It was intense. I found something. I found my window to the world. I went to that bigger school because I said, I have to see if I can compete. I was in a drama department with 20 or 30 kids, and so I was able to get leads and, you know, learn everything. It was that 1 year there was fantastic because I learned to do everything. I got a lot of acting roles. I learned to build sets. I learned all sorts of stuff. But Zach, I had to go to this Virginia Commonwealth, which had a student body of a drama department of over 200 students, so I had to see if I could compete. And by the time I came out of there, I said, yeah, I can compete.
It was like a reality test.
It was a reality test, I said, because what I knew was that if I could not compete professionally, I would teach.
So you knew you were staying in this field.
I knew I was going to stay in the theater, and it's that old saying that, you know, those who can do, those who can't teach.
Yeah.
So I said, well, if I can't do it, I'll teach it. And so I had a passion for it, and luckily I came out of college. I did an internship at the Oslo Theater, and that fall they called me and asked me to come on board as a part of the company, and I got my equity contract in 1970.
So you started as an actor.
I started as an actor. I worked as an actor for 4 years.
It's interesting because when you said that you could hear the voices,
mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, he must be thinking as a director.
I probably was, but didn't know it.
That's what it sounded like.
Yeah. I had that talent, but I didn't know that was directing talent. But by the time I was a junior, I was double majoring in directing and acting. And I knew I had an inkling back there that I always wanted to have my own theater, but I didn't really know what that meant. And I didn't know anything about the business of it. And not until I stopped acting.
Well, wait a minute. So how long did you stay at the Oslo?
I was at the Oslo for 3 years.
What kind of parts did you do?
I did George in Our Town.
Oh.
I did Jack in Charlie's Aunt. I did Ronnie in House of Blue Leaves.
Wow.
It was a great role.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was one of my favorite roles. I played multiple roles in a wonderful production of War and Peace that we did there that Eb Thomas adapted and directed, and I thought it was just a brilliant production. Lots of stuff.
Yeah, that's fine. No, that's fine.
That
I just wanted...
That's 40 years ago. Yeah.
Oh,
I was a little boy.
Oh, yeah.
My
mommy
took me.
Okay, so 3 years, you're at the Oslo. You're having the time of your life,
yeah.
Apparently. I mean, you know, you're doing all these wonderful roles.
That was a great period for me because I was working in... There wasn't that much theater in America at the time. Oslo was the only theater in the state of Florida, basically, in the early 70s. We were bussing them in from Miami and West Palm, and they were staying on the weekends and seeing free shows. I'll never forget. I mean, the weekends, the parking lot out there behind where the old Oslo was filled with buses. Just filled with buses. And that's how the summer stayed full. And we played through Labor Day, from January through Labor Day, and I remember playing to mostly full houses. So those were heady days. But it was great for me because I was working with a lot of other people who were a lot more experienced than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to really just immerse myself.
Soak it up.
In classical rotating repertory theater. But I was obsessive also. On Mondays, on the day off, I taught mime because I had studied very intensively with an Italian mime artist in upstate New York by the name of Tony Montanaro. And that was probably my most influential master teacher. He was really extraordinary because he had studied with all of the greats. He had studied with Marceau and De Crew and all of the European mimes. And that was good. It wasn't, you know, mime in the park or on the streets. It was a very skilled...
Very classical.
Classical, highly disciplined. You had to be in great physical condition. And developing organic connections, that what it means to act without words.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a great period.
Now, this is so interesting to me because my admittedly limited experience of you, you're pretty verbal. Or at least that's how you seem to me, like somebody who's very comfortable, very articulate, very interested in the spoken word. So for you to be attracted to mime, acting without words.
I actually did not become verbal until I was started around the age of 25 or 26.
My goodness.
I was known to people as a very silent, quiet individual who talked very little, and it was true. I didn't speak much.
Were you shy?
I was shy, and I also came from a family that, although Southern, had New England roots.
Ah.
And
don't have anything good to say, don't say it.
You don't talk much, you know, and you look about you, and you learn the world.
Ooh.
And you learn the world by looking about you. And that was one of the best things my father ever taught me, was to look about you.
Yes.
And that's
great training for the theater.
The discipline of observation,
yes.
Observing others. And
yes,
so
yes.
That's probably one of my strongest suits that I was taught as a child and then developed in college further, because they teach you to observe, they teach you what that means, and you go into really detailed observation.
You had a head start.
I had a head start. And so I continue to love observing to this day. I'll sit at a water fountain and watch people come by, because no two people drink from a water fountain the same way. So I love sitting near a water fountain. I was getting an MRI the other day on my knee, and I was at the doctor's office, and there was a water fountain down the hall. So I sat where I could position myself and watched probably 30 people come get a sip of water from this water fountain. And you can determine their character by how they approach the water fountain. Press the button, lean over, or do they lean over and then press the button? Do they use it with both hands? Do they have to steady themselves when they're going down for the drink of water? It's just a joy to watch human beings behave.
And you know, it also, I mean, it's so much an actor's skill, you know, because you never know what you're going to need or where you're going to need it, you know.
Absolutely.
And also as a director, I mean, because you can use all of that.
Yeah, directing is really critical. You can help the actor that way, because I when I direct, interestingly enough, I direct physically. I stage the show, and I...
Do you get up there and do it? Is that what you mean?
No. I tell the actor what to do physically. I continue to hone the actor's performance physically about what they're doing physically, rather than approaching the psychology. I don't monkey much in an actor's psychology, because there's so many different acting techniques and approaches. I tend to stay very much on the outside of the actor's psyche and approach the play physically, and that goes back to my strong background in physical theater, but more importantly connects to the acting technique developed by Konstantin Stanislavski, the component that he calls the theory of physical action. And that was a theory that has been proven to be completely accurate now, more than a theory, and that is that if you can execute the same physicality the same way repeatedly, that will draw the emotion forward in you, whether it's crying or whatever. So if you can find the appropriate physicality to that feeling and repeat physicality.
This is different than sense memory.
That's correct. Sense memory is inside out.
That's right.
Theory of physical action.
It's outside in. Oh my gosh, I never heard of that.
Yeah. It was created by Stanislavski. His predecessor, who's poo-pooed way too much though, was Delsarte, who is poorly recognized as the guy who sort of invented melodrama, all of those stock gestures.
Yeah, this thing, right?
He didn't invent the stock gestures. He actually made studies. He spent his entire life studying.
He saw what people were actually doing.
He saw what people were. He was looking for patterns. How do people express grief physically?
Wow.
And so he would go to mine disasters and watch the women as they would learn of their husbands being killed in the mine. He would go to all these places and he would make drawings and find patterns of physical behavior. And they're true to this day. And they're using those kind of patterns in animation and things of that nature today.
Yeah, they're using it in lots of places, yeah. Actually, to tell whether people are telling the truth, they're lying, whether
right.
they're right.
See it on television.
Yeah, yeah.
Body language and all that stuff.
That's right. This is so obviously connected to look around ye. You know, I mean, so...
Look about you.
Look about you, sorry. Mm-hmm. So you were a natural convert, really, to all this observation, physicalization. It must have come quite naturally to you.
I mean,
yeah.
I became obsessed with it and remain obsessed with it to this day. I think whatever I pursued, I would probably become obsessed with it, because I have an obsessive nature, perhaps. But to this day, I have very few waking moments where I'm not thinking about the art in one way or another.
Ooh, talk to me a little
bit. Well, if I'm on the beach,
yeah,
and relaxing, and maybe I'm relaxing by reading a play, but if I'm relaxing by reading an article in the New York Times or something else, I'm still entranced by the physicalities and the behaviors going on around me. And that's the behavior of, you know, watching the activity on the beach on a windy day And how many times are people going to chase those umbrellas that go flipping down the beach? You know, the umbrella gets uprooted and the wind takes it away. And how do they deal with it? And then they put it back in the ground. And you have a whole story unfolding there. I mean, there was this one older couple down in front of me on Sunday afternoon, about 10 or 15 yards to my downright of me. And I'm watching them for 2 or 3 hours as their umbrella was blown away 2 or 3 or 4 different times, and how they dealt with it. And they finally got it figured out. They got it in deep enough, but they also understood that they had to point it into the wind, not let it go with the wind, because the wind would pull it out of the ground, no matter how deep they dug.
They put it right.
So they had to lean it into the wind. So just watching people's behavior was fascinating.
So it's a play. You're always watching a play.
There are plays going, stories going on all around us all the time, and they're usually hysterical.
Wow.
And some are maddening, but most of them are funny.
So for you, you are the quintessential observer.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
And as I said before, your early training really just set you up for that.
It did. I had good teachers.
Yes, I think you did.
Yeah.
I think you did. And it's ironic, and I know you said that you're obsessive and you would probably do whatever you did obsessively, and I'm sure you're right, but it seems to me, I mean, maybe this is a little too woo-woo, but it was like the theater person was waiting inside of you for the circumstances of life to present.
For sure, I was waiting inside of me for life to open a door.
And to say, this is it.
Here's a way to the world.
Yeah, right. You know, that actually spoke to you.
Right. Everybody finds it differently. I mean, there are people who don't find it. Perhaps for some people it comes later. I do know people who find their bliss at the age of 40 or 50 or even 60.
I agree.
And because they just couldn't, it wasn't offered to them before that, and they didn't think to explore that area.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I also think that we don't live in a culture that supports that, encourages that, values it. Hmm. We live in a culture that says, do whatever you're told to do and don't complain about it.
Yeah.
So lots of people never get permission to even look.
That's true. Life is very interesting that way. I find that one of my greatest frustrations working in the theater today, because I find so many, about 70 or 80% of the people working in the theater, even the professional theater, have become conventional.
Mm.
And not creative, and they're doing it the way they're told it should be done.
They're not at the edge?
No. It's just amazing to me, because everybody is looking for the right way to do it, and they're looking for models, whether it's a model of managing a theater or whether it's the model of how do you act, mm-hmm. Instead of getting the basics down and then practicing the basics and learning for yourself and reinventing things for yourself. I just find that amazing to be in a creative, in what's considered a creative art form, and to find so much conventionalism around me.
Well, I think in a way you're making my point, and I agree, obviously, because it was my point, that people are afraid. You know, that the culture supports caution.
Human
and
beings
not
are
risk.
Afraid. We're herd animals.
Yes, that's
we're,
right.
We're
that's
afraid
right.
that if we're pushed to the that's outside,
bad
like
things
a herd
will
animal,
happen. Bad,
yeah, the wolves will eat you.
That's right.
And, you know, they will if you're a human being. You have to survive in the herd. That's why
it's a delicate balance, to quote some playwright, right?
I think that was Edward Albee.
I think so too.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance.
You know. And it is, I think, a sign of a certain kind of personal security to be willing to go to the edge ever. And that's...
I think it's either a sign of security or it's a sign of stupidity
I knew
or ignorance.
Because
I have found myself going to the edge many times, whether it's creatively, artistically, or in speaking out against something that I think is a bad idea in arts, the way funding is happening in society. And, oh my gosh, I catch hell for it. Oh yeah, yeah, because then people refer to me as outspoken. But I'm just saying what I think.
Yes. But that's really interesting, as though outspoken was some kind of pejorative thing.
I know.
I mean, really, what is that, you know?
I wish everybody was saying more what they think, and I wish more people were more angry. I think there would be less horror in the world today.
I agree. But again, I think that we are mostly discouraged, actually.
Yes, we are. We are, and we're encouraged to go along and to go with the herd and to go with the mass.
So it's wonderful that FST actually does present cutting-edge stuff.
We do a wide variety. We do comedies and musicals and edgy stuff. That, I mean, our production of Ruined last year people were shocked that we were doing what is predominantly black play. There are 13 people in the play, and one is white. It's also mostly about women.
Oh my!
And it's about something that we in America don't know about much and don't care about much.
Yeah.
But what I found then, it was a universality in the play that was extraordinary, and I thought we had to do it, and that's why we did it. Now, I don't know, that was a Pulitzer Prize winner. That's not an edgy play, but it's a huge risk to take.
Yes.
Because they're two different words there. One is risk, and the other is edgy. You can do edgy plays and not take any risk at all.
What are you thinking of?
The Goat by Edward Albee.
Oh, yeah,
it
right.
was a huge hit on Broadway.
Yeah.
It's very edgy in its content, very conventional in its form, and does great box office, but it is perceived as an edgy play.
Right, but
there's
it's not
no
a
major
risk.
Risk in
no,
it.
No, I got
now,
it.
Now, I can turn around and produce a brand new musical that's very happy and sort of fluffy, and no one has ever produced it before, and it's a tremendous risk because you don't know whether or not
it's going to go over. Right.
You don't know how the public's going to respond to it.
No,
you know?
No.
So those two words are so frequently misconstrued and considered to be the same thing, and they're not
and
the
they're
same
not,
thing
no, no, no.
at all. No.
No.
Nicholas Nickleby is not a risk.
No.
Nicholas Nickleby is going to do great business if you do it well. It's a huge challenge and a huge undertaking, but it will do fantastic business, as Howard Millen proved at the Oslo 10 years ago whenever
right.
they did it.
Right. You know? And Menopause the Musical is going to do great box office.
No
almost
risk.
No matter what you do to it.
There's no risk in that play and there's no edge in that
that's
play.
Right, that's right.
That's one that has
that's right. Okay, so back me up here. So now you're a conservatory member at the Oslo, and you've done your 3 years.
Right. No, not a conservator, I was an actor.
I mean, you were an actor.
Right.
Sorry
right.
about that. Right.
Yeah.
So they you're a member.
You're the MFA program in those days.
No, you're a member of the troupe.
Right.
Okay. So you've done your 3 years, teaching mime on the side.
Right.
And then what?
I was flush. I felt great about my ability. I had money in my pocket.
Mm-hmm.
My loans were paid off. I had a brand new car, and it was paid for. I started driving up the East Coast visiting friends. My destination was New York. I was going to leave my car with a friend in New Jersey, get on a boat, and go to Europe and write a book called Mimes on Mime.
Wow.
Because there was a book called Actors on Acting, and there was a book called Directors on Directing, and I said, I'm going to do one on mime.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started corresponding with some of the mimes and the contacts that I had in various parts of Europe. And I was going to do some of the American artists as well. There just weren't that many. I got sidetracked in Washington, D.C. when I stopped by to visit a friend whose name is Rainer Schein. We had gone...
I just got it.
We had gone to school together. His name then was Rainer Johnston.
Uh-huh.
And he changed his last name to Schein, S-C-H-E-I-N-E, when he joined Actors Equity.
Is it R-A-Y?
Uh-huh, R-A-Y-N-O-R.
Oh, okay.
And so he got tremendous press. I mean,
he
got a paragraph in Playboy magazine, which he was most proud of. For having a name. Rainer has been a very successful character actor since college. Anyway, I stopped off to visit Rainer. He was living in a house, what in those days was called a group house, in a very nice part of Washington, up on Northwest Washington, D.C., on MacArthur Boulevard, just outside of Georgetown. And there were also four of the most beautiful women living in that house. So I thought I'd hang around for a while. First, I was there to see my buddy, and then my buddy was living in his house with all of these beautiful women, and he was the only guy. And then I started watching theater in Washington at the Washington Theater Club, Arena Stage, and there were a couple of dinner theaters, and I said, this might be a good place to start a theater, because I'd always had that in the back of my head that I'd like to have a theater. And I went down and spoke with Tom Fitchhandler, who was then the executive director of Arena Stage. He and his wife, Zelda, had founded Arena Stage with someone else. Anyway, they were one of the biggest, most successful theaters, regional theaters in the country, and told them that I was interested in starting a theater. Tom didn't think experimental would work. Or that I would find much success with that. So I went back and rethought and decided to start a children's theater because there wasn't much of that in Washington, D.C., and I thought I could do experimental theater and do it for children, but because they didn't know what was experimental, they wouldn't know I was experimenting. They would either like it or not like it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's
They wouldn't have a judgment on it.
They wouldn't have a judgment because they have no preconceived ideas.
Right. Wonderful.
So I had a great time doing that. In the beginning, for the first 18 to 20 months, struggled, collected unemployment, spent a lot of my savings. But eventually it took off, and within 2 or 3 years it had become a successful touring company, touring up and down the east coast of the eastern seaboard from Maine to Florida. We eventually got a residency at Eckerd College as well, so by then I had had two companies touring up and down the east coast. And with that residency, the Southeast was much more, less competition and much more rich. Mm-hmm. So I moved our headquarters in 1978 down to St. Pete, and we had a lot of free space that people had given us, and we started a theater in an old movie house. It was a porn house we cleaned up. And
literally.
Yeah, yeah. And that was on Central Avenue. And right around my sixth year, I left and went to work at freelance because by then I had had two, I was only 20, what was I? I was in my late 20s, no, maybe I was in my early 30s. This was 1979. I had two touring companies and that operation on Central, and I said, man, I'm turning into a banker. I'm sitting at a desk all day and not doing the stuff I really wanted, which was the art. Mm-hmm. And I said, the only way out of here is just out. You know, I can't fix it.
From here.
From here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go back to freelancing and see what happens. And I...
Ever the risk taker.
Yeah, just find times to go. Just follow your bliss and just do it. And I just left. And I shocked a lot of people. And I lived on Treasure Island, Sunset Beach at Treasure Island, and worked out of there and freelanced for 9 months.
Freelanced as a?
As a director.
Mm-hmm.
And during that whole time, the part I left out of this is that the guy who founded Florida Studio Theater was John Spellman, who was a buddy of mine from the Oslo. He was director of education there when I was an actor at the Oslo. And I had, during that time, I had directed a show or two for John, and I had written one or two plays or adaptations for him that he produced here. And so I was still in touch with him.
So this was already here.
He founded Florida Studio Theater as an alternative touring theater, touring to migrant camps, prisons, and out of, to populations that otherwise would not have theater.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very experimental.
Mm-hmm.
He had a core company of four actors when I directed for him, and they were great. They were very well trained. One of them, Louis Tyrrell, is now and has been the producing director of Florida Stage in West Palm. And he's been doing that for over 20 years. He founded that theater. Anyway, that operation that I had up there eventually became American Stage in St. Pete.
Oh.
And that's what is American Stage today. I lived on the beach, but then John was going through a lot of personal things. He asked me to come down here and take over for a year while he went on a sabbatical. I said, okay, that'll be a good transition for me. I'll have a guaranteed income for a year. Then I can pocket some money, get ready to go back to New York. And
maybe write Mime on Mime.
And John didn't come back.
Oh.
He fell in love, got married, had a child, but we traded places, didn't know it was going to happen. He lived in Washington, D.C., and I came back to Sarasota. And when I had left Sarasota, I frankly left in 1970, the summer of 73, saying, I will never go back to that dull, old, conservative town as long as I live. So when I came back in 1980, I was really shocked to see that, oh, the town has gotten
hipper.
Younger,
mm-hmm.
hipper. And I'd gotten a little older.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. The convergence, right? They'd gotten a little younger.
Right.
You had gotten a little older.
So it worked. It worked. And we just started. The theater did not have a resident operation at the time. And one of the deals was, I'll keep the tour running, John, but I want to do a resident season.
Mm-hmm.
John's great. So we took what is now the Keating Theater and was an empty hall. It was a rehearsal hall with some bleachers in it and 72 chairs. And we started doing a season there. And we sold one of the vans. I think he had three vans for touring, two or three. And we sold one of the brand new ones for $12,000 to install a new lighting system. And we did a six-show season. And we sold 450 subscriptions. And we were off.
And you were off. And you had a theater.
And we had a theater.
No,
and
you.
Then John didn't come back, and so the next year it grew again. And actually, we grew the subscription base the next year to 1,200 subscriptions.
Holy cow.
And the year after that to 1,800, and the year after that to 2,400. I remember because it was so important to me, because I had been running a touring theater. You have to understand why I really wanted a subscription audience and why I'm so passionate about it. When you run a touring theater, you don't have an audience. You see those people once, and boom, you're out of there. You don't have a relationship.
Right.
I said, if I'm going to run a theater, I want to have a relationship with my audience. And that means I want a subscription house so they can keep coming back. They can talk to me and I can talk to them.
Right.
I'll push them as far as I can. When they rebel, they'll push me back.
That's right. It's a relationship.
It's a relationship.
Right, right, right.
And so we've had a great relationship. And from that little start with 450 subscriptions, we've grown now to three theaters with 9,500 subscribers in the main stage, 7,800 in the cabaret, and still growing and reaching 60,000 children with our touring programs and reaching over 100,000 adults every year. So, yeah. But it's still growing. And
yes,
we're still working
it. I know. And I'll bet you still have plans.
Oh, yeah. We've got lots of plans.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure. You don't want to say anything about what you might be thinking about doing, what your future plans might be.
For?
Yourself, for the theater?
I hope to stay at the theater and do my 50 years.
Well, when is 50 years?
I've done 30.
So, 2030?
That's correct. It would be 2030.
Wow.
Is that right? Hold it. I came in 1980, so it would be 2030. Right. So 20 more.
All right.
Okay, if my health holds, and I think it will. My father lived until he was 94. My great-grandmother lived until she was 99.
You're in great shape.
I hope. But I've been a bad boy more than my dad was a bad boy. I've lived a harder life when I was in the theater. But I shouldn't say I lived a harder life. He was in the Army.
Mm.
Anyway, I have a lot of plans. I mean, I'm not finished. Florida Studio Theater's not finished, but the other part of that plan is to bring good mid-career professionals in around me and give more of the reins over to them as I continue to grow the theater in the next decade and take a role that's more artistic and less engaged in day-to-day operations.
Yeah.
But just bigger picture and the projects I want to work on. Because it's so neat. There's so many things there's so much to do here. We've got three great theaters, five great programs, and so much to do that lots of people can be happy here and can have their artistic home here. And I don't have to have an ego about it because I can give people lots of opportunity.
And so when you begin to move away from the bulk of what you've been doing and moving into a more creative kind of life, mm-hmm. Are we talking mostly about directing? Are we talking about writing?
Directing and creating. Directing and writing and creating. I'm not a great wordsmith. I'm a very good architect.
Yes.
In terms
you have ideas.
Play structure, how to structure a play so I can take found material. I've been engaged in creating most of our cabaret pieces, and I'm good at taking that material, structuring it, editing it, and all of that. We've got a great staff, though. Rebecca Langford has been here for going on 13 years and is our managing director, so she's got the bulk of the management off of me.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Alexander's been here with me for 30 years, and so she chairs a lot of the artistic. We need more artistic support. We're going to be hiring up more resident artistic people.
And what would the job description of that be?
Resident director.
Oh.
We could probably use two resident directors if they taught as well. We're producing so much work, and we have so many plans to produce more work.
Wow.
And plans to renovate the Gumperts Theater and add a lot of brand new, build on to the Gumperts with a new lobby, new restrooms, really turn that into a fantastic theater. You know, we inherited an old theater
that
needs a lot of work.
It was Theater West, wasn't it?
It was Theater Works.
Theater Works, right.
And almost every theater in town, Oslo was there years ago. It was, the Oslo owned it. Howard Millman was telling me the other day, the Oslo owned it back in the 60s, and they sold it to Anita Katzman for $25,000. I know. I won't tell you what we paid for it. You can look it up in public records, and then you'll really go, ooh.
And you didn't have a van to sell, huh?
We didn't have a van to sell, no. We're still paying it off. Anyway.
Yeah, but it's actually a very good space.
You know, we didn't buy it for the theater. We bought it for parking.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, my God.
No, we were, our parking was in danger because we used the bank across the street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember.
Yeah, and that became endangered, and we said, if we're going to survive the long term, we need to own our own parking. We looked across the street and said, let's go talk to the Katzmans.
Right.
And we did. We talked to them for about 6 months and got it worked out and bought that property for the parking and said, great, this got a second theater, another theater on it.
Right.
The theater is in terrible condition. It's a tremendous amount of work.
Right.
But we'll make it functional and see whether or not we want to build a new one on that
right.
property
right.
or what.
Or just fix it.
But in the meantime, or just fix it, right. And so we've gone through 5 years of figuring out what we want to do. And
you've done some very good work there, though.
We've done some great work there, mm-hmm. yeah. And it's pretty comfortable for the audience, except it needs bathrooms and lobby. And that's the first thing we're going to add and build. And then we're going to renovate the interior of the auditorium and stage area.
Mm-hmm.
So that in that order. And that'll be happening in the next 3 years. So we've got a lot to do. And we're building out our improv program. We just did the improv festival this past weekend.
Yeah, it was very successful.
Very successful. We had 13 different troupes performing, 60 different performers from all over America.
Wow.
And all that happened in 28 hours. Every house was completely sold out. And we're going to continue to grow that and start bringing improv groups in more frequently and continue to grow our improv troupe.
Mm-hmm.
So it's we're in a good place. We've got a lot of growth to do. Just a lot of plans, dreams, and ambitions, too.
I know. You never stop, right?
I don't want to.
No, I wasn't saying it as though...
You're right. I can't even stop at the beach.
No, that's right. That's right. Everything...
The umbrella turns into a mime show.
I know. Everything is grist for your mill, right?
No, that's true.
Yeah. That's what it means, it seems to me, to be completely who you are.
I was in therapy many years ago, and my shrink asked me, Richard, when do you most feel yourself?
Yes.
And I said, when I'm in rehearsal. I didn't have to think a minute.
That's a great question.
It is a great question. Mm-hmm. It's a question I continue to ask myself, when do you most feel yourself?
Yes.
You know, and it's when I'm in rehearsal, and it's when I'm in the...
You're in the work.
In the furnace of creativity.
Yes. You're in the work.
Yeah, really
right.
in it.
Right.
Yeah, because rehearsal and creative process, when you're working with creative people, it's a pretty safe place to be. It doesn't mean that there's not abrasion. There's frequently a lot of abrasion. But you know, generally speaking, nobody's going to pull a gun on you. They might hurt your feelings and that stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a lot of push and pull, but nobody's going to pull a gun on you.
No.
The danger is psychic danger.
Yes.
It's what's going to happen to your psyche if this goes south, and how bad is it going to injure my psyche if this is a major disaster, and how much humiliation will I endure?
How much can I take?
Right.
But you've been pretty successful.
Oh, we've been very successful.
Yeah.
I've had very few, in over a 30-year career at Florida Studio Theater, I've had very few humiliating moments. Far and few between. So that's been
it must be a statement, actually, of your talent.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
I just love what I do.
Well, it's very, very clear. And so I always ask the same question.
Mm-hmm.
To just think about what it's been like to live a life as you have, dedicated to an art, the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have something that you would say about that?
Well, two parts. I really am appreciative and honored that I've had the opportunity to spend the last 40 years in the professional theater. And at the same time, I am deeply saddened that this universe we live in holds art in such low esteem. And that includes anywhere you want to look. Everyone sort of thinks art should be free. And, you know, I would have to agree with that. But somebody's got to
pay for it. Right.
And finding a solution to that in our American society has been very difficult. That said, we have more theater happening in America today per capita than ever before in the history of the United States. So we should be pleased and proud of that. It's just the battles that we have to fight, though, and the amount of time and energy exerted in fighting those battles, whether they're with governments or foundations, whatever. It's amazing that what you have to liken it to, here's the easiest way to think about it, is to think about it in terms of where education was in the year 1910 and where art is in the year 2010. And if you go back to 1910, you'll find out that, well, only certain populations were allowed to go to school.
Right.
And there wasn't public school mandated as we know it. People did not see the value of it.
Right.
And that's the same sort of societal value I'm talking about, is that the same way education elevates a society, art elevates a society. And it goes back to that mantra that culture is to the family what the family is to the individual. So as an individual, you know how important your family is. And for the family, culture is tremendously important. And culture being, you've heard that word, culture being your immediate core culture and those people who are of your same core culture. If you're Southern, or if you're Jewish, or if you're Jewish-Southern. Or if, you can go on and on with that. And it's been really interesting to watch the oil spill in Louisiana, and watch those people go on television and how much they talk about how their way of life and their culture is being destroyed. And that's having resonance with people. People understand that. It's very, very interesting. But we have a culture and we have art, and sometimes art is seen as the icing on the cake instead of people really... And I think the general population recognizes that it's not the icing on the cake, that it is indeed the cake, or better yet, it's the steak. Of life.
Mm-hmm.
And people were living in caves 10,000 years ago, putting art on the walls.
Yes.
People were gathering around the fire 10,000
telling
years
stories.
Ago, telling stories and making their own theater, and we're going to do it no matter
right.
how little we have.
It humanizes.
It makes us, it tells us what it means to be human. It tells us what it means to be alive.
Yeah.
So that's a sad part of that. Darn, I wish more people saw the import of this and so that it could be a little bit easier on the artists. And I'll, you know, clarify that, yeah, there is a pecking order. There are excellent artists and there are those who are not as excellent and mediocre and people who should not be in it.
Mm-hmm.
And those people who shouldn't be in it usually get out because it's a highly competitive world. But boy, those people who are in it deserve as much support as we can find for them.
Yes.
I hope that enlightenment and that support will grow in the years ahead.
Well, certainly Florida Studio Theater has done its bit.
We have.
Yes, you have.
We'll keep doing our bit.
Yeah, yes. We're counting on it.
Yeah, we make it available to people. We've got the lowest prices in America for ticket prices, and we do that on purpose. It's a part of our mission. We've said that when I came here in 1980, we said, let's make this affordable, and by that we meant, let's make this as affordable as it is to go to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that everybody, just about everybody who wants to, can enjoy it. And that's why we have one of the largest subscriber-based theaters in America. You know, we're in the top 10.
Holy
this God. Little theater is in one of the top 10 in America. It's amazing. It's not a little theater anymore. It's three
Yeah,
small
it's not
theaters.
A little theater.
So we're when we have all three houses running, we're playing to 450 to 500 people a night. One performance. If we do two shows that night, we're playing to 1,000 people. And not to mention the workshops and things that are going on. So, but we're doing our bit for the audience.
Yes. And at the same time, you're allowing the people who got captured by theater the way you did to have access to it, to work. It's win-win all over the place.
Yeah, it is.
It's great.
Yeah, and we've got a great audience, and we live in a great town.
We live
and
in a great
town.
I have
to say that... You know, when I'm saddened by people not supporting the arts, that's generally speaking not true of Sarasota.
No, we're very lucky here.
Most supportive audiences anywhere, and that's why we have so much art here.
Mm-hmm.
The audiences are tremendously supportive.
This has been great. Thank you very much, Richard.
Good talking to you. Yeah, pleasure.
So, you heard it. When does he feel the most himself? When he's in rehearsal. So that is the language of a man who knows himself, has found himself, knows how to put himself where himself needs to be. And that, of course, is the statement of someone who is, at least in those moments, exactly who he really is. And I'm hoping that in listening to this interview, you've been curious yourself about what you might not yet have found in yourself. And that you are willing to look about ye, or look within ye, and see if you can find something you've denied, something which you need, because I don't know if you heard it in Richard, I did, that wonderful sense of being home with yourself. It's wonderful, and it's what I'm hoping for all of us. So I realized that I forgot to give my website or say anything about me, actually, I don't have a whole lot of time, so I'm going to give you my website, which is thelynshow.com. It's T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E. Don't forget the E. You'll find a different Lynn. thelynshow.com. And on there, you can find where it says to email me. You can do just that if you like. You've got something you want to tell me, question you want to ask me. And you will find out everything you need to know about me is up there on that website. So if you have any questions of any of it, you can certainly email me. In addition, you can email me and ask me to get you Josh Hackney, who is the guy who makes this show sound as good as it can. Also the guy who teaches me what I need to know and then reminds me of the things that he has taught me that I have promptly forgotten. Oh, my God, the learning curve attached to this. But they tell me that the brain is most likely to survive if you keep challenging it, and so I keep challenging it. As always, I hope that you heard something you can use today, something that triggered something inside of you, something you knew but had forgotten, something you never knew, something that'll bring you back. Because I will be here, same time, same station. And I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still still got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may have got